Chapter 6, Freud and Jung, Contrasts. The difference between Freud's views and my own ought really to be dealt with by someone who stands outside the circles of influence of those ideas which go under our respective names. Can I be credited with sufficient impartiality to rise above my own ideas? Can any man do this? I doubt it. If I were told that someone had rivaled Baron Munchausen by accomplishing such a feat, I should feel sure that his ideas were borrowed ones. It is true that widely accepted ideas are never the personal property of their so-called author. On the contrary, he is the bondservant of his ideas. Impressive ideas which are hailed as truths have something peculiar to themselves. Although they come into being at a definite time, they are and always have been timeless. They arise from that realm of procreative psychic life out of which the ephemeral mind of the single human being grows like a plant that blossoms, bears fruit and seed, and then withers and dies. Ideas spring from a source that is not contained within one man's personal life. We do not create them. They create us. To be sure, when we deal in ideas, we inevitably make a confession, for they bring to the light of day not only the best that in us lies, but our worst insufficiencies and personal shortcomings as well. This is especially the case with ideas about psychology. Whence should they come except from the most subjective side of life? Can experience with the objective world save us from subjective prejudgments? Is not every experience, even in the best of circumstances, to a large extent subjective interpretation? On the other hand, the subject also is an objective fact, a piece of the world. What issues from it comes, after all, from the universal soil, just as the rarest and strangest organism is nonetheless supported and nourished by the earth, which we all share in common. It is precisely the most subjective ideas which, being closest to nature and to the living being, deserve to be called the truest. But what is truth? For the purposes of psychology, I think it best to abandon the notion that we are today in anything like a position to make statements about the nature of the psyche that are true or correct. The best that we can achieve is true expression. By true expression, I mean an open avowal and a detailed presentation of everything that is subjectively noted. One person will stress the forms into which this material can be worked, and will therefore believe that he has created what he finds within himself. Another will lay most weight upon the fact that he plays the part of an observer. He will be conscious of his receptive attitude and insist that his subjective material presents itself to him. The truth lies between the two. True expression consists in giving form to what is observed. The modern psychologist, however unbounded his hopes, can hardly claim to have achieved more than the right sort of receptivity and a reasonable adequacy of expression. The psychology we at present possess is the testimony of a few individuals here and there regarding what they have found within themselves. The form in which they have cast it is sometimes adequate and sometimes not. Since each individual conforms more or less to a type, his testimony can be accepted as a fairly valid description of a large number of people. And since those who conform to other types belong nonetheless to the human species, we may conclude that the description applies, though less fully, to them too. What Freud has to say about sexuality, infantile pleasure, and their conflict with the principle of reality, as well as what he says about incest and the like, can be taken as the truest expression of his own psychic makeup. He has given adequate form to what he has noted in himself. I am no opponent of Freud's. I am merely presented in that light by his own short-sightedness and that of his pupils. No experienced psychotherapist can deny having met with dozens of cases, at least, which answer in all essentials to Freud's descriptions. By his avowal of what he has found in himself, Freud has assisted at the birth of a great truth about man. He has devoted his life and his strength to the construction of a psychology which is a formulation of his own being. Our way of looking at things is conditioned by what we are, and since other people are differently constituted, they see things differently and express themselves differently. Adler, one of Freud's earliest pupils, is a case in point. Working with the same empirical material as Freud, he approached it from a totally different standpoint. His way of looking at things is at least as convincing as Freud's, because he also represents a well-known type. I know that the followers of both schools flatly assert that I am in the wrong, but I may hope that history and all fair-minded persons will bear me out. Both schools, to my way of thinking, deserve reproach for overemphasizing the pathological aspect of life and for interpreting man too exclusively in the light of his defects. A convincing example of this in Freud's case is his inability to understand religious experience, as is clearly shown in his book, The Future of an Illusion. For my part, I prefer to look at man in the light of what in him is healthy and sound, and to free the sick man from that point of view which colors every page Freud has written. Freud's teaching is definitely one-sided in that it generalizes from facts that are relevant only to neurotic states of mind. Its validity is really confined to those states. Within these limits, Freud's teaching is true and valid, even when it is an error, for error also belongs to the picture and carries the truth of a true avowal. In any case, Freud's is not a psychology of the healthy mind. The morbid symptom in Freud's psychology is this. It is based upon a view of the world that is uncriticized or even unconscious, and this is apt to narrow the field of human experience and understanding to a considerable extent. It was a great mistake on Freud's part to turn his back on philosophy. Not once does he criticize his premises or even the assumptions that underlie his personal outlook. Yet to do so was necessary, as may be inferred from what I have said above, for had he critically examined his assumptions, he would never have put his peculiar mental disposition naively on view, as he has done in The Interpretation of Dreams. At all events, he would have had a taste of the difficulties which I have met with. I have never refused the bittersweet drink of philosophical criticism, but have taken it with caution, a little at a time. All too little, my opponents will say. Almost too much, my own feeling tells me. All too easily does self-criticism poison one's naivete, that priceless possession, or rather gift, which no creative man can be without. At any rate, philosophical criticism has helped me to see that every psychology, my own included, has the character of a subjective confession, and yet I must prevent my critical powers from destroying my creativeness. I know well enough that every word I utter carries with it something of myself, of my special and unique self, with its particular history and its own particular world. Even when I deal with empirical data, I am necessarily speaking about myself, but it is only by accepting this as inevitable that I can serve the cause of man's knowledge of man, the cause which Freud also wished to serve, and which, in spite of everything, he has served. Knowledge rests not upon truth alone, but upon error also. It is perhaps here where the question arises of accepting the fact that every psychological teaching, which is the work of one man, is subjectively colored, that the line between Freud and myself is most sharply drawn. A further difference seems to me to consist in this, that I try to free myself from all unconscious and therefore uncriticized assumptions as to the world in general. I say I try, for who can be sure that he has freed himself from all his unconscious assumptions? I try to save myself, at least, from the crassest prejudices, and am therefore inclined to recognize all manner of gods, provided only that they are active in the human psyche. I do not doubt that the natural instincts or drives are forces of propulsion in human life, whether we call them sexuality or the will to power. But I also do not doubt that these instincts come into collision with the spirit, for they are continually colliding with something. And why should not this something be called spirit? I am far from knowing what spirit is in itself, and equally far from knowing what instincts are. The one is as mysterious to me as the other, yet I am unable to dismiss the one by explaining it in terms of the other. That would be to treat it as a mere misunderstanding. The fact that the earth has only one moon is not a misunderstanding. There are no misunderstandings in nature. They are only to be found in the realms that man calls understanding. Certainly instinct and spirit are beyond my understanding. They are terms that we allow to stand for powerful forces whose nature we do not know. As may be seen, I attribute a positive value to all religions. In their symbolism, I recognize those figures which I have met with in the dreams and fantasies of my patients. In their moral teachings, I see efforts that are the same as or similar to those made by my patients when, guided by their own insight or inspiration, they seek the right way of dealing with the forces of the inner life. Ceremonial, ritual, initiation rites, and ascetic practices, in all their forms and variations, interest me profoundly as so many techniques for bringing about a proper relation to these forces. I likewise attribute a positive value to biology and to the empiricism of natural science in general, in which I see a Herculean attempt to understand the human psyche by approaching it from the outer world. I regard the Gnostic religions as an equally prodigious undertaking in the opposite direction, as an attempt to draw knowledge of the cosmos from within. In my picture of the world, there is a vast outer realm and an equally vast inner realm. Between these two stands man, facing now one and now the other, and, according to his mood or disposition, taking the one for the absolute truth by denying or sacrificing the other. This picture is hypothetical, of course, but it offers a hypothesis which is so valuable that I will not give it up. I consider it heuristically and empirically verified, and what is more, it is supported by the consensus gentium. This hypothesis certainly came to me from an inner source, though I might imagine that empirical findings had led to its discovery. Out of it has come my theory of types, and also my reconciliation with views as different from my own as those of Freud. I see in all happening the play of opposites, and derive from this conception my idea of psychic energy. I hold that psychic energy involves the play of opposites in much the same way as physical energy involves a difference of potential, which is to say, the existence of such opposites as warm and cold, high and low. Freud began by taking sexuality as the only psychic driving power, and only after my break with him did he grant an equal status to other psychic activities as well. For my part, I have subsumed the various psychic drives or forces under the concept of energy in order to avoid the arbitrariness of a psychology that deals with drives or impulses alone. I therefore speak not of separate drives or forces, but of value intensities. By what has just been said, I do not mean to deny the importance of sexuality in psychic life, though Freud stubbornly maintains that I do deny it. What I seek is to set bounds to the rampant terminology of sex, which threatens to vitiate all discussion of the human psyche. I wish to put sexuality itself in its proper place. Common sense will always return to the fact that sexuality is only one of the life instincts, only one of the psychophysiological functions, though one that is without doubt very far-reaching and important. Beyond all question, there is a marked disturbance today in the realms of sexual life. It is well known that when we have a bad toothache, we can think of nothing else. The sexuality which Freud describes is unmistakably that sexual obsession which shows itself whenever a patient has reached the point where he needs to be forced or tempted out of a wrong attitude or situation. It is an overemphasized sexuality piled behind a dam, and it shrinks at once to normal proportions as soon as the way to development is opened. It is being caught in the old resentments against parents and relations and in the boring emotional tangles of the family situation, which most often brings about the damming up of the energies of life. And it is this stoppage which shows itself unfailingly in that kind of sexuality which is called infantile. It is really not sexuality proper, but an unnatural discharge of tensions that belongs to quite another province of life. This being so, what is the use of paddling about in this flooded country? Surely, straight thinking will grant that it is more important to open up drainage canals. We should try to find, in a change of attitude or in new ways of life, that difference of potential which the pent-up energy requires. If this is not achieved, a vicious circle is set up, and this is in fact the menace which Freudian psychology appears to offer. It points no way that leads beyond the inexorable cycle of biological events. This hopelessness would drive one to exclaim with Paul, "Wretched man that I am, who will deliver me from the body of this death?" And our man of intellect comes forward, shaking his head, and says in Faust's words, "Thou art conscious only of the single urge, namely, of the fleshly bond leading back to father and mother, or forward to the children that have sprung from our flesh. Incest with the past and incest with the future, the original sin of the perpetuation of the family situation. There is nothing that can free us from this bond except that opposite urge of life, the spirit. It is not the children of the flesh, but the children of God who know freedom." In Ernst Barlich's tragic novel of family life, The Dead Day, the mother demon says at the end, "The strange thing is that man will not learn that God is his father." That is what Freud would never learn, and what all those who share his outlook forbid themselves to learn. At least, they never find the key to this knowledge. Theology does not help those who are looking for the key, because theology demands faith, and faith cannot be made. It is in the truest sense a gift of grace. We moderns are faced with the necessity of rediscovering the life of the Spirit. We must experience it anew for ourselves. It is the only way in which we can break the spell that binds us to the cycle of biological events. My position on this question is the third point of difference between Freud's views and my own. Because of it, I am accused of mysticism. I do not, however, hold myself responsible for the fact that man has, everywhere and always, spontaneously developed religious forms of expression, and that the human psyche from time immemorial has been shot through with religious feelings and ideas. Whoever cannot see this aspect of the human psyche is blind, and whoever chooses to explain it away, or to enlighten it away, has no sense of reality. Or should we see in the father complex, which shows itself in all the members of the Freudian school, and in its founder as well, convincing evidence of any release worth mentioning from the inexorable family situation? This father complex, fanatically defended with such stubbornness and oversensitivity, is a cloak for religiosity misunderstood. It is a mysticism expressed in terms of biology and the family relation. As for Freud's idea of the superego, it is a furtive attempt to smuggle in his time-honored image of Jehovah in the dress of psychological theory. When one does things like that, it is better to say so openly. For my part, I prefer to call things by the names under which they have always been known. The wheel of history must not be turned back, and man's advance towards a spiritual life, which began with the primitive rites of initiation, must not be denied. It is permissible for science to divide its field of inquiry and to set up limited hypotheses, for science must work in that way. But the human psyche may not be parceled out. It is a whole which embraces consciousness and is the mother of consciousness. Scientific thought, being only one of its functions, can never exhaust all the possibilities of life. The psychotherapist must not allow his vision to be colored by the glasses of pathology. He must never allow himself to forget that the ailing mind is a human mind, and that, for all its ailments, it shares in the whole of the psychic life of man. The psychotherapist must even be able to admit that the ego is ill for the very reason that it is cut off from the whole, and has lost its connection with mankind as well as with the spirit. The ego is indeed the place of fears, as Freud says in The Ego and the Id, but only so long as it is not returned to the father and mother. Freud shipwrecks on the question of Nicodemus. Can a man enter his mother's womb a second time and be born again? To compare small things with great, we might say that history repeats itself here, for the question once more comes to the front today in a domestic quarrel of modern psychology. For thousands of years, rites of initiation have been teaching spiritual rebirth. Yet strangely enough, man forgets again and again the meaning of divine procreation. This is surely no evidence of a strong life of the spirit. And yet the penalty of misunderstanding is heavy, for it is nothing less than neurotic decay, embitterment, atrophy, and sterility. It is easy enough to drive the spirit out of the door. But when we have done so, the salt of life grows flat. It loses its savor. Fortunately, we have proof that the spirit always renews its strength in the fact that the central teaching of the ancient initiations is handed on from generation to generation. Ever and again, human beings arise who understand what is meant by the fact that God is our Father. The equal balance of the flesh and the spirit is not lost to the world. The contrast between Freud and myself goes back to essential differences in our basic assumptions. Assumptions are unavoidable, and this being so, it is wrong to pretend that we have made no assumptions. That is why I have dealt with fundamental questions. With these as a starting point, the manifold and detailed differences between Freud's views and my own can best be understood.